This is Michael Silverblatt. The great American writer Joan Didion passed away recently. It was my honor to have several bookworm conversations with her. Today, we are re-airing a conversation from 2011 about her memoir, Blue Nights, the most personal and poetic book of her career.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm.
People who know the sound of my voice know that my voice is full of the awe that I feel to be in the presence of a writer I truly admire. Her book is called Blue Nights. It's published by Knopf, and I thought we would begin by hearing its opening section. This is Joan Didion reading.
In certain latitudes, there comes a span of time, approaching and following the summer solstice, some weeks in all, when the twilights turn long and blue. This period of the blue nights does not occur in subtropical California, where I live for much of the time I will be talking about here, and where the end of daylight is fast and lost in the blaze of the dropping sun. But it does occur in New York, where I now live. You notice at first, as April ends and May begins, a change in the season. Not exactly a warming, in fact, not at all a warming. Yet suddenly summer seems near, a possibility, even a promise. You pass a window, you walk to Central Park, you find yourself swimming in the color blue. The actual light is blue. And over the course of an hour or so, this blue deepens, becomes more intense even as it darkens and fades, approximates finally the blue of the glass on a clear day at Chartres, or that of the Cherenkov radiation thrown off by the fuel rods in the pools of nuclear reactors. The French called this blue, this time of day, l'heure bleue. To the English it was the gloaming. The very word gloaming reverberates, echoes, the gloaming, the glitter, the glamour, the glimmer, the glisten, carrying in its consonants the images of houses shuddering, gardens darkening, grass-lined rivers slipping through the shadows. During the blue nights, you think the end of day will never come. As the blue nights draw to a close, and they will, and they do, you experience an actual chill, an apprehension of illness at the moment you notice. The blue light is going. The days are already shortening. The summer is gone. This book is called Blue Nights because at the time I began it, I found my mind turning increasingly to illness, to the end of promise, to the dwindling of the days, the inevitability of the fading, the dying of the brightness. Blue nights are the opposite of the dying of the brightness, but they are also its warning.
Joan Didion reading the opening of her book, Blue Nights. This is a memoir at first concerned with the death of your daughter, Quintana Roo, and following the year of magical thinking. Did you think you'd be writing such a book?
No, I had no idea. I had some idea that I would write a book about having children. And then as I got deeper into it, or as I began to write it, I realized that it wasn't about having children in the abstract. It was about my child. And that led to thoughts of death because she had died. And thoughts of death led to the blue nights, and the minute I thought of the blue nights, I knew what the book was about. I mean, it was about aging and death, which was certainly on my mind.
As you read the book, you discover that the subject is one that really hasn't been broached in literature before. There have been people who want to help you age or even want to help you die, but
the assumption is that you don't have to.
Yes. And that a work of literature, by and large, doesn't take it up. It's almost as if writers avoid that. You know, Tolstoy does it in The Death of Ivan Ilyich, but by and large, writers don't like to come to the final moment. It's a subject.
No one likes to come to the final moment.
So that when I reached the last 20 or so pages, I said, oh my, we're going to go as far to the edge in this book as it's possible to go.
Well, I'm so glad you thought that.
It's a stunning thing. I think it can only be put along with King Lear and some of the other works of approaching madness or approaching the end.
Well, I didn't think I would finish this book. I kept thinking I would set it aside. I would abandon it. I've abandoned books before, and this one seemed eminently a candidate for being abandoned. And because I wasn't having a good time with it. Well, naturally, I wasn't having a good time with it when I look back on it. It was not a good time book.
Yeah. How did you find yourself able to complete it?
Well, I just decided I had to and then suddenly I found a rhythm. Sometimes you just make a stab in the dark and try and exhibit some blind faith that it will take you home.
Now, you had said in what's become a famous interview for the Paris Review that once you've written the first couple of pages, a book is doomed to the terms in which you've created
for it. You've got to use the terms, yeah.
And what seemed to happen in this book, to me for the first time, were that the terms of the book
were loose.
Were goose and opened.
Mm-hmm.
There seemed to be a point in which the fragments, the bits of mosaic, the special sentences made room for new ones, and the book took on, as I thought of it, it went from the fugue state of grief to a fugue itself. It became
music.
A piece of music.
It seemed like music to me when I got into it. I can't explain it, but it was definitely more like music than anything I'd ever written.
And it seemed as if, how to put this, what the balance came from the beauty of the repetition lines against the simple direness of the facts of the hospital and the doctors, that suddenly the short lines, the single lines, became balanced between structure and desperation. And the book took a special form of completion. I don't think I've heard it before, even in your work.
Well, it really finished itself. I mean, it took itself home in a way that I couldn't do.
And do you know when you get there?
Do you know when you're home?
Yes.
Yes.
How?
It just feels right. It feels as if you don't have to do any more.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking to Joan Didion about her book, Blue Nights, which begins with the death of her daughter, Quintana. Now, it seems to me that in this book, you rip open really incredible wounds because you open the possibility that you haven't been a good mother. And I think most parents would rather die.
I think most parents feel, though, that they haven't been good parents, whether they admit it or not. I mean, most people don't admit most stuff.
Why is that possible for you?
Why is it possible? It's mm-hmm. necessary for me to admit the absolute worst that I can imagine.
Because it brought to mind, I'm a close reader and rereader of your work, some things that you had said in your essay on keeping a notebook. You had said, "Although I have felt compelled to write things down since I was 5 years old, I doubt that my daughter ever will, for she is a singularly blessed and accepting child, delighted with life exactly as life presents itself to be, unafraid to go to sleep and unafraid to wake up." And I thought, wow, you know, for someone to have been able once to have said that, to be facing these facts now, seems an incredible act of opening up to the possibilities of life at its worst.
Mm-hmm. It that's where it led me, yes. And when it started leading me there was when I kept thinking, you don't have to finish this. you can abandon this book. You can set it aside.
And there was the question of whether it was your story to tell.
I always, there is. I mean, if you're writing about another person, especially another person in your family, to whom you owe some special loyalty, yes, it's a huge question whether it's your story to tell. And I felt very strongly that certain aspects of this story were not mine to tell, and so I kept pushing them off and fighting and trying not to tell them. And I realized you had to.
That may be part of the tension of the book, because so famously with your first book, Slouching Toward Bethlehem, you say that a writer is always selling someone out. And the impulse not to, because in this case mm-hmm. it's your daughter, mm. must create a really
tension.
Terrible yeah. tug.
Yeah. It did. So I kept doing what I called what I thought of as rambling, but I mean the rambling actually kept leading me back to the same place.
You go to the Greek tragedians, that it is a tragedy to outlive one's children, to live through the death of one's children. Does that give you perspective?
The idea of the tragic of the tragic.
Yes.
Yes, it does. It's because it's been with me since early childhood. I mean, the first things I read really were the Greeks.
Do you feel as if you or your family have flown against the gods?
No, I don't. I never felt that. I don't think of Greek tragedy as going against the gods. No, that would be approaching feeling sorry for yourself, which is a form of hubris all by itself, you know, which we have to avoid.
How do you avoid feeling sorry for yourself?
Well, because it's been on my mind as something to avoid forever. And so it's just something I try to do.
Were you taught it?
Was I taught it?
Yeah.
Well, I was taught about its value.
Because I remember one of the most startling things I've ever read anywhere is in one of your essays in which you were told to consider, instead of crying, putting a paper bag on your head.
Yes.
And you say, it was useful. It's kind of an amazing, I mean, at a time where feeling sorry, and as a nation, as a culture, as an individual, as a people, seems to be, you know, the national mood.
Well, if you can find yourself feeling better just by putting a bag on your head, you would do it.
Does it work? Does it still
just
work?
Just like this, it cuts off the oxygen. I mean, it cuts off oxygen. It does something physiological, which works.
Wow,
It was explained to me, actually, how valuable this would be.
That it was an alternative also to taking a cold shower.
Right. It's a much more effective than a cold shower and more available.
I'm talking with Joan Didion. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. Joan Didion has written Blue Nights. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
This episode with Joan Didion originally aired in 2011.
I'm talking with Joan Didion about her book, Blue Nights. It's a stark and moving look into the abyss, the complexities of the parent-child relationship, the grief that follows the death of a child, the grief that follows that death means inevitable aging and approaching death itself. I asked Joan if she would do us the favor of reading us from what I think of as the final fugue of the book. Some of the references in it will pass you by, but I think it is the definition of what turns this book into music. This is Joan Didion reading from The End of Blue Nights.
Whole days now spent on this question with no possible answer. Who do I want notified in case of emergency? I think it over. I do not want even to consider in case of emergency. Emergency, I continue to believe, is what happens to someone else. I say that I continue to believe this, even as I know that I do not. I mean, think back. What about that business with the folding metal chair in the rehearsal room on West 42nd Street? What exactly was I afraid of there? What did I fear in that rehearsal room if not an emergency? Or what about walking home after an early dinner on 3rd Avenue and waking up in a pool of blood on my own bedroom floor? Might not waking up in a pool of blood on my own bedroom floor qualify as an emergency? All right, accepted. In case of emergency, could apply. Who to notify? I try harder. Still, no name comes to mind. I could give the name of my brother, but my brother lives 3,000 miles from what might be defined in New York as an emergency. I could give Griffin's name, but Griffin is shooting a picture. Griffin is on location. Griffin is sitting in the dining room of one or another Hilton Inn, a few too many people at the table, a little too much noise, and Griffin is not picking up his cell. I could give the names of whichever close friends in New York come to mind, but the close friends in New York who come first to mind are actually, on reflection, not even in New York. Out of town, out of the country, away, certainly unreachable in the best case, possibly unwilling in the worst. As I consider the word unwilling, my lagging cognition kicks in. The familiar phrase need to know surfaces. The phrase need to know has been the problem all along. Only one person needs to know. She is, of course, the one person who needs to know. Let me just be in the ground. Let me just be in the ground and go to sleep. I'm able to imagine telling her because I still see her. Hello, mommies. The same way I still see her weeding the clay court on Franklin Avenue. The same way I still see her sitting on the bare floor crooning back to the 8-track. Do you want to dance? I want to dance. The same way I still see the stephanotis in her braid. The same way I still see the plumeria tattoo through her bridal veil. The same way I still see the bright red soles on her shoes as she kneels at the altar. the same way I still see her in the darkened upstairs cabin on the evening Pan Am from Honolulu to LAX, inventing the unforeseen uptick in Bunny Rabbit's fortunes. I know that I can no longer reach her. I know that should I try to reach her, should I take her hand as if she were again sitting next to me in the upstairs cabin on the evening Pan Am from Honolulu to LAX, should I lull her to sleep against my shoulder, should I sing her the song about Daddy gone to get the rabbit skin to wrap his baby bunny in, she will fade from my touch, vanish, pass into nothingness. The Keats line that frightened her. Fade as the blue nights fade, go as the brightness goes, go back into the blue. I myself placed her ashes in the wall. I myself saw the cathedral doors locked at 6. I know what it is I am now experiencing. I know what the frailty is. I know what the fear is. The fear is not for what is lost. What is lost is already in the wall. What is lost is already behind the locked doors. The fear is for what is still to be lost. You may see nothing still to be lost. Yet there is no day in her life on which I do not see her.
Joan Didion reading the final passages from Blue Nights. Now, I think you discovered that construction out of single sentences. Some people called it a mosaic. It now seems more musical than visual. In Play It As It Lays. And it was truly a breakthrough, it seems to me. And here, it comes to a kind of culmination. You've done this thing that seems to be the most demanding or difficult thing in your style. It's absolutely quintessential. A Didion page becomes recognizable because of the presence of single sentences and strong repetitions. And here it is, and if it's as if you're speaking in these final pages almost from beyond life, from beyond the grave, in a state of recognition that only this process of breaking things down into single sentences, it's not just poetry, it's syllogism, it's logic.
It's logic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it seems to lead you to a place from which there is no consolation, but consolation is no longer necessary.
Well, consolation is necessary, of course, always. I mean, in our real life. But when you do reach a place where consolation doesn't matter. If everything is going well when you're working on something.
I think that part of what makes it so effective on the page is that the reader is being addressed so directly present to a process of thought, and yet you're not here. I can't reach out and touch Joan Didion and say, oh, I'm so sorry, or I don't know how it will be okay, but it will be. And so the page, in bringing the reader so close, there's also an acknowledgement that there's a closeness that can't be achieved mm-hmm. with the reader, that we've come in to a witness of grief that no camera could give us access to, that only prose can give us, and yet we're cut off from it. And when a book ends this way, that feeling of being ripped apart.
But don't you think that the experience of someone you know dying is exactly that? You're separated from them, and it's the separation that is that makes it unsupportable.
Yes, but Joan, whoever before has said, the thing I fear is no longer that she'll die, but that I won't remember her, that I won't be seeing her and thinking of her every day. Mm. And then on that recognition, which, you know, perhaps so much thought and grief expends itself on, the book ends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an extraordinary, you know, thing. And, you know, there we are, brought up short against the fact.
But it had to end there. There was no place to go.
Yes, that Joan Didion is feeling very deeply and yet using the equipment of a master dramatist. That, you know, did that experience writing the play of The Year of Magical Thinking help you in some sense?
I think it helped me become more open. And it was valuable in about a million different ways. One thing it made me understand, which I had never really fully understood before, was that there is a true collaboration between the audience and the playwright or the writer. And there is a true collaboration, obviously, between any writer and any reader.
When you say collaboration,
yeah,
that's what the reading felt like, that you no longer needed to go through certain steps. I'd been inculcated.
Mm-hmm.
That the writer...
You could follow it. You could track it.
I could follow it.
Yeah.
There was an instruction process.
Yeah.
Or like the recitation of a poem that you've come to know. You don't maybe understand the poem, but you know the rhythms
mm-hmm.
that are involved here, and you complete them for yourself.
Mm-hmm. That's perfect.
That's what poetry does.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is what you've wanted your prose to do from almost the beginning.
I did. I mean, consciously, even. But I didn't know how to get there. Gradually, I've learned how to get there.
What a price.
Yeah.
Wow. I've been speaking with Joan Didion on the occasion of the publication of Blue Nights. It's published by Knopf. Thank you, Joan, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Blue Nights at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Special thanks to Bookworm show collaborators Alan Howard and Sean Sullivan and technical director PJ Shahamat. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.